George Silverman's explanation by Charles Dickens scanned, and proof by David Price CCX074 at Coventry. Ack. Ack. George Silverman's explanation. First chapter. It happened in this wise, but, sitting with my pen in my hand looking at those words again, without descrying any hint in them of the words that should follow, it comes into my mind that they have an abrupt appearance. They may serve, however, if I let them remain, to suggest how very difficult I find it to begin to explain my explanation. An uncouth phrase. And yet I do not see my way to a better. Second chapter. It happened in this wise, but, looking at those words, and comparing them with my former opening, I find they are the self-same words repeated. This is the more surprising to me, because I employ them in quite a new connection. For indeed I declare, that my intention was to discard the commencement I first had in my thoughts, and to give the preference to another of an entirely different nature, dating my explanation from an anterior period of my life. I will make a third trial, without erasing this second failure, protesting that it is not my design, to conceal any of my infirmities, whether they be of head or heart. Third chapter, not as yet directly aiming at how it came to pass, I will come upon it by degrees. The natural manner, after all, for God knows that is how it came upon me. My parents were in a miserable condition of life, and my infant home was a cellar in Preston. I recollect the sound of father's Lancashire clogs on the street pavement above, as being different in my young hearing from the sound of all other clogs. And I recollect, that, when mother came down the cellar steps, I used tremblingly to speculate on her feet having a good or an ill-tempered look, on her knees, on her waist, until finally her face came into view, and settled the question. From this it will be seen, that I was timid, and that the cellar steps were steep, and that the doorway was very low. Mother had the gripe and clutch of poverty upon her face, upon her figure, and not least of all upon her voice. Her sharp and high-pitched words were squeezed out of her, as by the compression of bony fingers on a leathern bag. And she had a way of rolling her eyes about and about the cellar, as she scolded, that was gaunt and hungry. Father, with his shoulders rounded, would sit quiet on the three-legged stool, looking at the empty grate, until she would pluck the stool from under him, and bid him go bring some money home. Then he would dismally ascend the steps, and I, holding my ragged shirt and trousers together with a hand, my only braces, would faint and dodge from mother's pursuing grasp at my hair. A worldly little devil was mother's usual name for me. Whether I cried for, that I was in the dark, or for that it was cold, or for that I was hungry, or whether I squeezed myself into a warm corner, when there was a fire, or ate voraciously when there was food, she would still say, "Oh, you worldly little devil!" Apostrophe, apostrophe, and the sting of it was, that I quite well knew myself to be a worldly little devil. Worldly as to wanting, to be housed and warmed, worldly as to wanting to be fed. Worldly as to the greed with which I inwardly compared how much I got of those good things with how much father and mother got, when, rarely, those good things were going. Sometimes they both went away seeking work, and then I would be locked up in the cellar for a day or two at a time. I was at my worldliest then. Left alone, I yielded myself up to a worldly yearning for enough of anything except misery, and for the death of mother's father, who was a machine maker at Birmingham, and on whose decease, I had heard mother say, she would come into a whole courtful of houses, if she had her rights. Apostrophe worldly little devil, I would stand about, musingly fitting my cold bare feet into cracked bricks and crevices of the damp cellar floor, walking over my grandfather's body, so to speak, into the courtful of houses, and selling them for meat and drink, and clothes to wear. At last a change came down into our cellar. The universal change came down even as low as that, so will it mount to any height on which a human creature can perch, and brought other changes with it. We had a heap of I don't know what foul litter in the darkest corner, which we called the bed. Apostrophe for 3 days mother lay upon it without getting up, and then began at times to laugh. If I had ever heard her laugh before, it had been so seldom that the strange sound frightened me. It frightened father too, and we took it by turns to give her water. Then she began to move her head from side to side, and sing. After that, she getting no better, father fell a-laughing and a-singing, and then there was only I to give them both water, and they both died. Fourth chapter, when I was lifted out of the cellar by two men, of whom one came peeping down alone first, and ran away, and brought the other, I could hardly bear the light of the street. I was sitting in the roadway, blinking at it, and at a ring of people collected around me, but not close to me, when, true to my character of worldly little devil, I broke silence by saying, I am hungry and thirsty. Apostrophe apostrophe, does he know they are dead? Apostrophe apostrophe asked one of another. Do you know your father and mother are both dead of fever? Apostrophe apostrophe asked a third of me severely. I don't know what it is to be dead. I supposed it meant that, when the cup rattled against their teeth, and the water spilt over them. I am hungry and thirsty. Apostrophe that was all I had to say about it. The ring of people widened outward from the inner side as I looked around me, and I smelt vinegar, and what I know to be camphor, thrown in towards where I sat. Presently someone put a great vessel of smoking vinegar on the ground near me, and then they all looked at me in silent horror as I ate and drank of what was brought for me. I knew at the time they had a horror of me, but I couldn't help it. I was still eating and drinking, and a murmur of discussion had begun to arise respecting what was to be done with me next, when I heard a cracked voice somewhere in the ring say, "My name is Hawkyard. Mr. Verity Hawkyard, of West Bromwich." Apostrophe then the ring split in one place, and a yellow-faced, peak-nosed gentleman, clad all in iron gray to his gaiters, pressed forward with a policeman and another official of some sort. He came forward close to the vessel of smoking vinegar, from which he sprinkled himself carefully, and me copiously. He had a grandfather at Birmingham, this young boy, who is just dead too, apostrophe said Mr. Hawkyard. I turned my eyes upon the speaker, and said in a ravening manner, "Where's his houses?" Apostrophe apostrophe, ha! Horrible worldliness on the edge of the grave, apostrophe said Mr. Hawkyard, casting more of the vinegar over me, as if to get my devil out of me. I have undertaken a very slight trust in behalf of this boy, quite a voluntary trust. A matter of mere honor, if not of mere sentiment. Still I have taken it upon myself, and it shall be, oh, yes, it shall be, discharged. Apostrophe, the bystanders seemed to form an opinion of this gentleman much more favorable than their opinion of me. He shall be taught, apostrophe said Mr. Hawkyard, apostrophe, oh, yes, he shall be taught. But what is to be done with him for the present? He may be infected. He may disseminate infection. Apostrophe, the ring widened considerably. What is to be done with him? Apostrophe, he held some talk with the two officials. I could distinguish no word save farmhouse. Apostrophe there was another sound several times repeated, which was wholly meaningless in my ears then, but which I knew afterwards to be Hotten Towers. Apostrophe, yes, apostrophe said Mr. Hawkyard. I think that sounds promising. I think that sounds hopeful. And he can be put by himself in a ward, for a night or two, you say. Apostrophe apostrophe, it seemed to be the police officer who had said so. For it was he who replied, yes. It was he too, who finally took me by the arm, and walked me before him through the streets, into a whitewashed room in a bare building, where I had a chair to sit in, a table to sit at, an iron bedstead and good mattress to lie upon, and a rug and blanket to cover me. where I had enough to eat to, and was shown how to clean the tin porringer in which it was conveyed to me, until it was as good as a looking glass. Here, likewise, I was put in a bath, and had new clothes brought to me, and my old rags were burnt, and I was camphored and vinegared and disinfected in a variety of ways. When all this was done, I don't know in how many days or how few, but it matters not, Mr. Hawkyard stepped in at the door, remaining close to it, and said, "Go and stand against the opposite wall, George Silverman. As far off as you can. That'll do. How do you feel?" ... I told him that I didn't feel cold, and didn't feel hungry, and didn't feel thirsty. That was the whole round of human feelings, as far as I knew, except the pain of being beaten. "Well," said he, "you are going, George, to a healthy farmhouse to be purified. Keep in the air there as much as you can. Live an out-of-door life there, until you are fetched away. You had better not say much. In fact, you had better be very careful not to say anything about what your parents died of, or they might not like to take you in. Behave well, and I'll put you to school. Oh, yes. I'll put you to school, though I'm not obligated to do it. I am a servant of the Lord, George, and I have been a good servant to him, I have, these 35 years. The Lord has had a good servant in me, and he knows it." ... What I then supposed him to mean by this, I cannot imagine. As little do I know when I began to comprehend that he was a prominent member of some obscure denomination or congregation, every member of which held forth to the rest when so inclined, and among whom he was called Brother Hawkyard. It was enough for me to know, on that day in the ward, that the farmer's cart was waiting for me at the street corner. I was not slow to get into it, for it was the first ride I ever had in my life. It made me sleepy, and I slept. First, I stared at Preston streets, as long as they lasted, and, meanwhile, I may have had some small dumb wondering within me whereabouts our cellar was, but I doubt it. Such a worldly little devil was I, that I took no thought who would bury father and mother, or where they would be buried, or when. The question whether the eating and drinking by day, and the covering by night, would be as good at the farmhouse, as at the ward superseded those questions. The jolting of the cart on a loose stony road awoke me, and I found that we were mounting a steep hill, where the road was a rutty by road through a field. And so, by fragments of an ancient terrace, and by some rugged outbuildings that had once been fortified, and passing under a ruined gateway, we came to the old farmhouse in the thick stone wall outside the old quadrangle of Houghton Towers, which I looked at like a stupid savage, seeing no specialty in, seeing no antiquity in, assuming all farmhouses to resemble it, assigning the decay I noticed to the one potent cause of all ruin that I knew, poverty, eyeing the pigeons in their flights, the cattle in their stalls, the ducks in the pond, and the fowls pecking about the yard, with a hungry hope that plenty of them might be killed for dinner, while I stayed there, wondering whether the scrub dairy vessels, drying in the sunlight, could be goodly porringers out of which the master ate his belly-filling food, and which he polished when he had done, according to my ward experience, shrinkingly doubtful whether the shadows, passing over that airy height on the bright spring day, were not something in the nature of frowns, sordid, afraid, unadmiring, a small brute to shudder at. To that time I had never had the faintest impression of duty. I had had no knowledge whatever that there was anything lovely in this life. When I had occasionally slunk up the cellar steps into the street, and glared in at shop windows, I had done so with no higher feelings than we may suppose to animate a mangy young dog or wolf cub. It is equally the fact that I had never been alone, in the sense of holding unselfish converse with myself. I had been solitary often enough, but nothing better. Such was my condition, when I sat down to my dinner that day, in the kitchen of the old farmhouse. Such was my condition, When I lay on my bed in the old farmhouse that night, stretched out opposite the narrow mullioned window, in the cold light of the moon, like a young vampire. Fifth chapter, what do I know of Hutton Towers? Very little, for I have been gratefully unwilling to disturb my first impressions. A house, centuries old, on high ground a mile or so removed from the road between Preston and Blackburn, where the first James of England, in his hurry to make money by making baronets, perhaps made some of those remunerative dignitaries. A house, centuries old, deserted and falling to pieces, its woods and gardens long since grassland or plowed up, the rivers Ribble and Darwen glancing below it, and a vague haze of smoke, against which not even the supernatural prescience of the first Stuart could foresee a counterblast, hinting at steam power, powerful in two distances. What did I know then of Hutton Towers? When I first peeped in at the gate of the lifeless quadrangle, and started from the mouldering statue becoming visible to me like its guardian ghost, when I stole round by the back of the farmhouse, and got in among. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.